I would imagine that every religion actually has silence at its core. But I don't think you can hope to connect on a deep spiritual level other than in silence.
Hey everyone, it is Raghu Marcus. I am back with Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network, and I have the pleasure to welcome Sarah Anderson. Sarah, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Raghu.
And Sarah has a bit of an oxymoron. We're doing a podcast about silence. We should just let it go. I have to tell you one. As soon as I saw the book and I started going through it, I'm so reminded of. I think you know who Ram Dass is. This network is dedicated to him, and so he had a stroke, and had tremendous difficulty speaking. And that was one of his wonderful powers, being able to transmit through words the Dharma or the spiritual profundities, shall we say. He was incredible. So then suddenly he had this stroke and could barely talk. He had to relearn how to talk. So it was obviously a huge, huge thing for him. And what happened, though, is in the midst of him speaking to audiences and so on, which he eventually could do, there was a lot of nothing between sentences because of his aphasia. He was looking for a word. Then he realized at some point, actually, this is perfect for people to be able to sit in this silence between thoughts and so on. So it became very much a meditation. So I just had to mention that to you because that illuminated what, to me, what your book illuminates in many different ways.
Silence is crucial, I think. And as you know, we all know, there's less and less of it nowadays. It's harder to find. And a lot of people are very, very scared of it, I think. And I suppose one of the things I wanted to do, attempt to do, is to show that it needn't be frightening. Mm. There are a lot of ways of being silent which are nurturing and unscary.
Mm.
So.
And you point them out as well. Well, we'll get to that, but I think we need to hear your story of how basically, obviously, and obviously, this became a very important part of your life, a practice, a way to transform this world. And there's some real trauma that you did go through when you were a child that led to this. Maybe you tell that story, it would be great.
Yes, when I was 10 years old, I was diagnosed with a very rare form of cancer, synovial sarcoma. And of course, when I was 10 years old, it was the dark ages of cancer, many, many years ago. And I had many operations, but finally they had to amputate my left arm. And I am, as you can probably hear, I'm British, not American. So people didn't talk about it. It was completely shrouded in silence. And actually, that suited me, because if it wasn't spoken about, I could pretend it didn't happen or hadn't happened. I went to boarding school when I was 11, and for the whole time I was there, not a single person asked me about my arm. And amazing. I don't think that would have happened in America, because to jump forward a bit, when I was in my early 20s, I went to the States for the first time. I went to New York. And one of the people just naturally said to me, "Hey, what's happened to your arm?"
Oh, yeah.
And it was a huge relief, actually.
Oh, really?
So, I mean, I'm sort of contradicting myself here, because on one level, I didn't want to talk about it, and I was pleased that no one had. Mm. And yet the moment I was given permission to talk about it, as I say, it was a huge relief. Mm. So I always have a very soft spot for America. So that was, yes. But there is another thing I'd like to say, is that when something like that happens to a child, in many ways it's much easier to adapt. It's something I don't think about. I went to a new gym class last week, and I was wearing a short-sleeve T-shirt. And the guy came up to me with two weights, the teacher. And he gave me one, so I took one. He said, "Take the other one." I said, "I can't take the other one. I've only got one arm." And he looked absolutely amazed. He hadn't noticed.
Wow.
And my theory is that he hadn't noticed, or people don't notice, because I don't think about it. I think if I was constantly thinking about it, then there would be people would notice.
Mm.
So that was my that's what happened to me as a child. And there were agonizing times, like going to teenage parties, which I was very, very loath to do. I hated all that. Anyway, I survived. And as I say, eventually came to America and had a, you know, very good time.
But what are the things that point to this silence and the importance of it in our lives? And, you know, for me, I connected very much with spiritual path, because I encountered it in so many different ways, you know, from when I was really young and went over to India, actually with Ram Dass. And so for you, how does it relate to an inner journey?
How does silence relate to an inner journey? I would imagine that every religion actually has silence at its core. I don't think you can hope to connect on a deep spiritual level other than in silence.
Mm.
And when I was doing some of the research for this book, well, as you know, I went on a retreat, Buddhist retreat, with Jack Kornfield in Spain.
That's our mutual friend.
Oh, right. I had been on Christian retreats before. I went to a Quaker meeting. So I tried to incorporate as many experiences as I could. It kept coming back to this silent center, really. I mean, I don't find it that easy. I live alone, so I live in quite a good deal of silence, but I don't think, a naturally silent person, although I do see the benefits, of course. One of the things that struck me was that historically, as we know, people from the West flooded to India in the 60s because they didn't think that the Western way of life, or Christianity indeed, had any silent meditation, because it had been sort of sidelined by the church. And what one of the things that amazed me was that when churches were closed, I'd always thought that was because they were frightened of theft, But apparently churches were closed because they were terrified of people praying silently. Because if you're praying silently, no one knows what you're, who you're praying to or what you're saying. I found that extraordinary.
Really? That's amazing. Jesus. Oh. And what other discoveries did you make when you really investigated into, because there's just incredible things from our past that point to how all of these cultures encountered silence in one or another different ways. What did you find from these, ancient, incredible Greeks, from the Greeks
what I found was that there is a link, a connection to all of them. And this connection or link is through the silence. When you don't need words, when you don't need to explain, you can just be in silence. I think that you have a deep connection with other people. I think also if you are silent, you become a much better listener. If people say, you're being selfish, you're not doing this, that, and the other, I think what they really appreciate, and I think in the book I give various examples of that, how there was a young girl who decided just not to talk for a week. And she said for the first time she was really listening to what her boyfriend was saying. Because it's very easy when you're chattering away not to hear the other person. Mm. So I think that was quite a discovery. Mm. I'd like to say one of the triggers for writing the book was a journey I made to the Antarctic, and I think it was 2005. And it was somewhere I'd always wanted to go because I paint, and I was fascinated by the turquoise and the blues in the icebergs. And so I was lucky enough to be on this Russian icebreaker. And we got off, every so often we'd get off and get into zodiacs and go in and out of the icebergs.
Mm, wow.
And one day we did this, and the guy turned the engine off and it was completely quiet. And then it began to snow and it was completely silent. And I think in many ways that moment is something that I've been trying to rediscover ever since. Mm. There was somebody I also write about, Admiral Richard Byrd, who was in Antarctica in the 1930s, and his descriptions of how he experienced. He was on his own for, I think, 3 or 4 months. And the most wonderful descriptions, which evidently he was quite loath to write about, because I think in the 1930s, it just probably wasn't the done thing for American males to write about their feelings. But he was persuaded, and he published a book called Alone. I think it's been out of print for years, but actually I thoroughly recommend it. It's very difficult. I mean, it wasn't, I would say that was my experience in the Antarctic, and Richard Byrd's as well. I mean, they were spiritual experiences, although you couldn't label them as such. I think there's that connection that you get with the a force or something is.
Through nature, for sure. I thought there was a lot, maybe you could tell this story about this, I guess it was a writer, Bracco The Croatian Gazer.
Oh, yes.
That's kind of interesting. Tell that one.
As I say, when I was researching the book, I was always on the lookout for interesting things to do and to experience. And I heard about this guy called Brako, who is a Croatian gazer, I think he calls himself.
Whatever that is.
He was giving a talk at St. James's Piccadilly, which has many talks like that. I think their program's called Alternatives, I think. So I was lucky enough to get a ticket and I went along and there were queues of people waiting to get in. And he eventually, I got into the church, having talked to quite a lot of people in the queue, and they'd come from literally all over the world. I mean, there was somebody who'd come from Australia and a lot of people from all over Europe. And so St. James's Piccadilly was very, very full. And there was actually quite a hiccup with the technology. But eventually a film was shown about Brako, and Naomi Campbell, the model Naomi Campbell, was saying how he'd changed her life. Because what he does is he just stands and looks at you or looks at the crowd. He hasn't apparently given an interview for years. Anyway, eventually a film about Brako was shown. And I think people saying how wonderful he was. And then towards the end of the evening, he actually appeared. So he went onto the altar at St. James's. And people surged forward. They obviously knew what they were doing, which I didn't. So I was sort of pushed backwards. And he just literally stood there for about 10 minutes, gazing. And I did feel, actually, even though I was far back, I did feel he was looking at me.
Wow.
And then he just walked away again. And the evening finished.
Never said a word.
As we left the church, we were each given a white rose, a dethorned white rose, which actually did come out on the next day. So, Brako, the Croatian gazer.
He never said a word.
Never said a word, no. He never does, apparently. And he's never given an interview.
Is he still alive?
Yes, he's not that old.
Oh, really?
I mean, one of the things that I would like to have had in the book, actually, I would like to have had illustrations. I've actually got together a PowerPoint, which I've given as talks here in England. And there is a picture of Brako, the Croatian gazer.
Oh, you got to send it to us. We got to put it up in the show notes.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. I'll tell you, though, my own personal experience was exactly that. I met Ram Dass. It's a whole complex story, but I won't get into it. But basically, when I met him, I just walked in the door. It was just him. He was a few feet away from me.
When was that?
This was at the end of the 60s, a long time ago. I was like early 20s. And he was famous for his beautiful baby blue eyes. And he, after he had met his guru named Karoli Baba, when I went back with him, when he went back the second time with a bunch of other Westerners and met him, but he was solidly in a very transformational place. He had transformed from Richard Alpert, the Harvard professor and psychedelic pioneer, into a being that, because you talked about listening before, he knew how to listen. He allowed his world to stop, and he had without an agenda, and we didn't speak at all for several, just doing this gazing, eye gazing that you were just speaking to. And it engendered a kind of trust that just led to intuitively knowing, okay, I'm on a path now, and I can let go of a bunch of the fear, you know, related to the stories we tell ourselves and the dark thoughts that are there constantly, especially when you're younger. And it transformed, as I said, transformed my life. And it was just through this exact thing. I can't, you know, it's really far out. This guy did that. I've never heard of anything like that, except Ram Dass has done that and did a lot more of it after his stroke, because he had lost his quote unquote entertaining Dharma talk ability. You know, I mean, he still spoke incredible truths and so on, but it was always filled with silence in between the words. And it's interesting what that does to people. I think, as you already mentioned, people can become very uncomfortable.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about that a little bit in terms of your own experience.
Yeah, I had dinner a couple of nights ago with an American friend who was reading my book. And he said, it's made me realize how much I hate silence. He said, I cannot be in a room without putting music on. I haven't got to the bottom of why it's so scary for people. Do you have a thought about that?
You know, when space isn't being filled, because that is what we are used to. Now it is insane what we are used to with social media, et cetera, and digital communications. You know, what do they call it? Doom scrolling? You're not even stopping. You know, you're just cause looking for the next.
And it gets on and on.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you go in a loop.
Yeah.
And once you start to, you know, so now we have all these kids that are doing this. And they're growing up in it. I have my granddaughters. I mean, they're just, you know, they've disappeared for me as they've gotten into teenagerhood.
Yeah.
And I think that, so in the absence of that stimulation, fear comes, right? We don't know how to just be. The spaciousness is lost of any sort. I mean, you did, and I read, of course, you did that meditation course with Jack and Trudy. And I know that a big part of what Jack attempts to convey to people is the development of a spaciousness through meditative practice, which is in silence. And in that spaciousness, there is a real ability to withstand, at the very least, in a worldly way, withstand life's vicissitudes, not reacting to absolutely everything that comes your way in a negative way, or even a positive way, for that matter. And so building up that spacious resilience, I would call it, is extremely important. And it's just obvious that silence and being comfortable in it is a big part of that. It's a big, big part of the, I mean, this is what attracted me when I saw your book. It attracted me to it because of my own experience with it, both in many different ways. I've been in circumstances where the pregnant silence was not pregnant with a connection. Okay. It was a bunch of people having some kind of reactive thing to being in that with strangers, being in that silence. I do believe we're in a very troubling time in terms of young people growing up in this and becoming less and less able to just be in the moment.
What's an interesting thought, which I hadn't actually I don't think I put in the book, but I thought about it subsequently, is that until 100 years ago or so, if you were on your own, there was no way you could break the silence apart from talking to yourself. I mean, now we, you know, with a press a button and or we've got so many ways that we can get rid of the silence. I mean, the radio, the television, social media. So it's a completely different world we live in.
I know. Utterly.
I think Aldous Huxley sort of ranted about the radio, saying it was the end of civilization.
Yeah, I read that. It's like, radio? Whoa, what about...
It's like,
He was wonderful, Aldous Huxley.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
He got to talk about silent... Ram Dass was friendly with him.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. And his wife, Laura. And he, at the end of his life, he was doing a lot of acid as well at the end of his life, and he was dying. But Ram Dass was with him in London, I believe, and he would just walk around. He couldn't say much anymore except one word. He'd look at everything, and it was like, you know, divine light manifestation. All he could do was extraordinary, extraordinary. I'll never forget that. I mean, you know, so that's somebody who had obviously deep spaciousness within him and was completely at ease in silence. And it, more than that, he knew that silence was a very much a practice as well as a joy to be in if you indeed weren't reacting to not to filling space.
Of course, he lived in, didn't he, the, I don't know, how do you say it, the Mojave Desert?
Yeah, Mojave.
Mojave, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, deserts, there's a whole chapter I have on deserts in general, which I think is...
That's great. Deserts are incredible. I mean, nature is one way, and you point this out, maybe you should flesh it out for us. How nature is a way in which we can develop a good relationship, at the very least, with silence.
Right. Nature can be very, very noisy. Earthquakes, storms, lightning, thunder. But it also can be supremely silent. I can't remember the name of the organization that attempted to find the most silent place in America. But what they found was this tiny spot in Olympic National Park in Washington State, which I don't know. Have you been there?
No.
No. It's, I think it's called 1 square inch. And it's literally a tiny little red rock. And I think it's about 4 or 5 miles from the car park. So you have to walk there, and of course it's not silent. You can listen. You can switch to it on YouTube, and there are the sounds of the forest. But I gather there are no planes that fly over that particular area, so it doesn't have any human sounds. And you're encouraged not to talk if you do go there. But there are, of course, I mean, deserts can be noisy as well with wind, but they can be very silent. I've been lucky enough to go to the, I can't possibly pronounce it, but the salt pans in Botswana, which is an extensive desert, totally flat. And there's a feeling of space and silence there. Another desert I went to in Oman, which is a completely different kind of desert with rolling sand dunes. And that wasn't very silent either because it was very, very windy. But of course, if you go back to early Christians, there were a whole lot of monks in about the 3rd century AD who called the Desert Fathers. who went off to live silently in the desert. I always associate deserts with silence, actually. I don't know.
Mm.
But
for me, it's caves.
Seeing,
For me, it's caves.
Oh, caves.
Yeah. Yeah, caves.
Yes, I didn't. I don't think I didn't write about caves at all, actually.
You mentioned them, you know, that in India in particular. And that's where I have spent not long times, but going into caves. That there's one very famous cave that near a place called Rishikesh in northern India, famous place where many from trekkers to yogi people go to. And it's called Vashista, who was a great sage from time immemorial. And, you know, you think of something like that. So there's a cave there. They maintain it. People are allowed to go in it. And you think, yeah, it's part of some kind of, you know, it didn't really happen. There's a cave. Somebody must have gone in it, you know, 500, 600 centuries ago or something, but not thousands of years, which is what the reality apparently is, whatever reality is. Anyhow, I went there. It's kind of a spiritual tourist thing to do. I went inside this cave, completely dark, and you go, you know, maybe 50 feet in. And I just sat there in that silence. It was deafening, that silence. There was, because there, I don't think there wasn't, I don't remember there being planes flying over or any of that stuff. They keep the tourists that do come, you know, into an appreciation of not talking and so on. It was extraordinary, sir. I mean, the depth of that silence in that cave. And I go to it whenever I go back to that city. I go back to
you
India.
Do. Yeah. How long would you spend there?
In the actual cave?
Yeah.
Maybe an hour.
Right. Because what's interesting, not nature, not caves, but those anechoic chambers, which are completely so, that's meant to be the most silent. Have you ever done that?
No, I actually have not. No. Yeah.
I mean, I think astronauts are meant to go, they have to go into an anechoic chamber. I was on the radio recently in here in London, and the guy who was interviewing me had actually been in an anechoic chamber. And he had, I think you're only allowed 45 minutes, but most people can't stay that long. They panic. He said he was able to, he spent the full 45 minutes. I haven't done that. I don't know.
Yeah.
So interesting that that really does freak people out, that total silence.
Well, there's people who do it and take acid or psychedelics that go in those chambers.
Yes.
That
could
be interesting.
That could be very interesting.
So he's in one of the things, you know, that we just really did talk about in terms of what's going on in our culture these days, worldwide. Global studies of the differences in brain function between subjects living in quiet places or around noise have concluded that noise and distraction are toxic. It's almost impossible to ignore noise around us. We've evolved to react to it. And the word noise, this is interesting, comes from the Latin word nausea, seasickness, or maybe from the Latin noxia, hurting, injury, damage, or the Ionic Greek nausea, all of which have unpleasant associations. Again, we go back to what's going on in our society. Worldwide, in terms of what has happened with electronic digital communication, cell phones, and social media in particular, which is grabbing the attention. And I've a little bit of fear for what is going to happen, and this points to it, does it not?
It certainly does. I mean, there are lots of elements to the I mean, on a totally, it's not what you were referring to, but there's going to be an epidemic of deafness, which is something different because of the noise, because of loud concerts, because the, what are they called, the hairs in the cochlear, I think, in our ears, once they're flattened, and they flatten because of loud noise, and we can't, they don't grow again, they don't upright themselves. Whereas owls, who fly totally silently, if their hairs are ruined, they can grow new ones.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So they, so yes, I mean, that's an element, the deafness. But I mean, as you were saying, I mean, it is what's happening to people if they're just completely surrounded by noise. It's very difficult to escape from, and it's very worrying. Yeah.
Well, I stood up in front of Jimi Hendrix back then. And I'm assuming, I'm not assuming, I know I'm hearing, I have hearing problems. And I probably, and I do ascribe it to the, being in those concerts, you know.
Yeah.
It was worth it, Sarah. That's all I got to
say. Yes, I'm sure it is.
Oh my God. A disturbing thing that I read in the book, and it's around your chapter around religious perspectives, was the silencing of women is traced back to the Iliad. Talk about, how did you discover that? And this is a dark mark on the human evolution that is in, you know, all the way to today, where, you know, people in work, where you have women and men, and how they react to women who are strong-willed and assertive, and versus men. I mean, so this has been going on forever. Yeah, talk about that.
Forever, yes. No, it has. The silencing of women. I think that the reason I discovered that was that somebody has recently written a book about a novel, I think. So that's, in a way, that's a bit of a cheat. It wasn't original research, that. But I just...
Well, pointing to it is what, yeah.
Yeah. Going back to... there was a man whose name I can't remember at the moment, who lived a solitary life in Maine, in the woods of Maine, for, I think, 27 years he was there. Do you remember that in the book?
Yeah, I don't remember his name, though.
Yeah, I can't remember his name. Doesn't matter. I mean, he'd got disillusioned with society, and so he just went off and lived on his own for 27 years in a camp. He'd built himself a sort of camp in the middle of the Maine woods. And he survived by stealing food from local houses. He never took more than he needed. And he also stole books. And the extraordinary thing, he was not discovered for 27 years. And when he was discovered, unfortunately, he was put into jail.
But
he allowed a journalist to come and interview him. And the journalist wrote a book about it. But one of the things that is interesting is that, as I say, he stole books, which I think he then returned when he'd read them. And because he was living in total silence, he remembered everything he read, which is, I mean, as you know, it's very, because we're surrounded by noise, we're full of distractions, and it's difficult, well, I find it difficult to remember things, to remember what I read, because I don't have that total silent concentration. I live in London.
I live more in the country, in a little town in California. So we've got a little bit more quiet here. Yeah, that's an amazing story that somebody went out there for 27 years.
Yes.
Right? And just foraged through vacation home leftovers.
Exactly.
And then books became such a part of the. Hopefully they didn't put them away too far gone, too long.
Well, I hope not. I mean, yeah, anyway.
Mm-hmm. You know, another thing, there's some great references here that you make to various, to a large number of prominent people. And like this person you talked about who went in Maine for 27 years and did what he did. Yeah, you have a lot of different characters here, which I loved. How did you come to that? I mean, and how do you even know about all these? I mean, I know you did some research, but.
Yes. Well, as you probably saw at the beginning, there's quite a page of acknowledgements.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, people I know.
Yeah.
You know, I asked them to recommend things, and then people would volunteer books and things to do. And so it was sort of, in that sense, quite collaborative, I suppose, which was, but, you know, I am a reader. I used to have a bookshop, so books are my thing.
Oh, that's right. You didn't tell us about that.
I started the travel bookshop in Notting Hill, which subsequently became very famous because of the film.
Yeah.
But I had it, long before the film. And it was I always felt somehow, people said, oh, how wonderful, you know, you sit in a bookshop and you read all day. I don't think I read for more than 20 minutes in the 35 years I had the shop. There's always something to do. But I felt that there was a kind of, well, silent osmosis, if you like. Mm. I felt that not only from other people coming in who were traveling all over the world, but also from the books. So, yeah, books are really my life. So I enjoy research and discovering things.
Yeah, well, it's nice.
And one thing leads to another. I mean, that's the great thing about it. That's what I love about research. You're going down one path and suddenly there are all these other paths off it.
Tributaries,
exactly. Mm. Yeah.
There's one thing here I have to quote a little bit. I really love your, and this is one of the references that we are speaking to just now. And Rilke, that in the Book of Hours, we should, people are doing the show notes here, make a note. Let's get the Book of Hours alongside of the Lost Art of Silence. And he connected silence and the divine, remarking that peace is important for finding silence. Rilke describes what is so familiar to many of us, the quote-unquote noisy riot of the senses. The challenge is how to get past these distractions and reach a deep interior silence where we can become aware of God. Rilke postulates that a way to do this is through meditation. I think Jack Kornfield probably mentioned that in your retreat in Spain. Again, this for me, that's I'm so happy you put that in there. That's a central reality for me of connecting silence and the divine or Buddha mind, whatever you want to call it, all of it pretty much the same. And how is that for you in your own life, the connection there?
This may not be exactly what you meant, but for me, meditation there has to be some kind of spiritual element to it. And I think that there are quite a lot of people nowadays who don't think that.
How so?
I think there's nothing to do with spirituality. I mean, they just, I wish I could remember that somebody, I think it's Ken Wilber actually, who says that, I think he says something like, actually, ultimately, it has to be a spiritual experience. I think, I don't know enough about it, but mindfulness, which a lot of people practice nowadays, I don't think necessarily has a spiritual element, does it?
No. Stockbrokers are doing mindfulness in order to better their attention and one-pointedness to make better trades.
Well, there you are. Exactly. You proved my point. Exactly.
But you know what? In that, you know, which is, there's a lot, I mean, that's a really gross example of it, but in, there's a lot of truth in there. But the other thing that happens, it's like, I have a friend who, his name is Krishna Das, and was with us in India with Ram Das and so on. He's probably the biggest purveyor of chant in the West, certainly, and now even in India. And he's amazing. So he exemplifies what the essence of what chant does to open up the field of silence inside somebody, where you calm down, you start resting in something that is not constantly as meditation does, and is not constantly taking you out of what Ram Dass called be here now, in the moment. And it's interesting because there's one chapter, and this is my life has been centered around music in a profound way for forever since I was. I met Ram Dass. I was a program director of a rock and roll radio station back then, and that's I have been very fortunate to have had music as a way to get to that internal silence. And you talk about it, and you bring up Aldous Huxley, who we were just mentioning, right? He said, after silence, that which comes closest to expressing the inexpressible is music. And I think your path has been with art, right? Painting.
Yes, yes. The music thing, I think, is very interesting because it's, I don't know whether you would agree with this, but many musicians that I spoke to said that it's the pauses in the music, which are where the art is. Arthur Schnabel said something like that. He said, I can play notes as well as anyone else, but it's the pauses. That's what the art is. Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
Yes, painting. I think that's another interesting way into silence. I do paint, and quite often what I do is go to an art gallery and draw a painting, and that's a fantastically good way of silent absorption and connection with the artist who did that painting. It's a fantastic privilege to be, you know, a foot away from a Leonardo when Leonardo was also a foot away from that. So that's, I think, really interesting. But and paintings, still lives, I think, have a wonderful silence to them, which just by looking, there's a Libyan writer called Hisham Mattar, who, when he was a student in London, used to go to the National Gallery every day in his lunch hour and just look at the same painting for weeks on end to really get that bond, that connection. And, of course, you do that silently. And of course, paintings are silent. I mean, paintings don't speak, but a Bruegel is a noisy painting, whereas that Munch's Scream, I actually think, is a profoundly silent painting because the scream's not being heard. It's very, I think, looking at paintings in that way is interesting. There's a Marc Grosco show on at the moment in Paris, which I'm going to go and see in a couple of weeks. And his paintings are wonderfully, well, silent, I think. There's a have you ever been to the Marc Grosco Chapel in, I think, it is it in somewhere in Texas?
No, no, not at all.
Which sounds interesting. Anyway, so I haven't been either.
I mean, all of these things, different, there's so many different methods to get to that silent place. The Quakers have, you know, a wonderful approach to connecting with that still small place inside us. And music and chanting and painting and writing and all of the arts certainly lend themselves to opening that door. And I guess if somebody gets to the point, but the first door is what we spoke to a little earlier, nature. Absolutely, you know, and even in the cacophony of going into the woods of the birds singing and animals speaking to each other, in that cacophony is a delightful silence, because the real silence to me is that your mind stops churning out this avalanche of thoughts and stories, right? So I think any way in which we can do a practice which leads us into a simple place of just being in the moment and not wrestling and struggling with yourself is just phenomenal. That you, I think if we take that step, and then going back to talking about youth and how are they going to get out of this jungle of cacophony of...
I can't, yeah. I mean, I can't see. I was thinking the other day, actually, I mean, I can't see. I was, I can't remember where I was now, but I saw what I sounds as funny to say this nowadays, but a hippie couple. I just thought, you know, maybe that's what people are going to have to do. They're going to have to, another 60s expression, drop out in some way. Because, I mean, I do know people, actually, who bring up their children. I'm sure you know who I mean, by Rupert Sheldrake.
Yep.
And his wife, Jill Purse, who are friends. And they brought up their two sons, I think, with no television. And they're but both boys are very, well, boys now, they're men, but incredibly creative. And one is a musician and the other is a biologist. But it, I think it's very, very difficult. At the moment, there's a thing at the moment saying that schools should ban smartphones for children. And of course they should. But it's very difficult when your child is the only child in the class that hasn't got one.
Yeah. I think there has to be another path. It's not lock the stuff up and lock your children in your homes and, you know, and not have them be in the world. I think I don't have any real way of defining what is possible, but I do believe that people realizing the importance of it. So, you know, as whoever there can be as mentors to suggest that finding a few minutes a day to relate in silence with the depth of oneself is extraordinarily important. And how we can relay that, and it has to be through the kind of mentors, you know, all the way to celebrities and so on, who can possibly help look at this Taylor Swift. I mean, what she, I mean, the phenomena is extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
You know?
Yeah.
And hopefully she'll use that in different ways to help people. Of course, she has to be helped herself to some kind of understanding of the value of a spiritual identity and the value of using silence to be able to engender that identity. So, I mean, I think that's a big part of what you've written here. The importance of it, no?
I hope so. I hope so. And I hope that by writing about ways that people might not have thought about, by looking at paintings, I mean, quite a few people have said to me that they hadn't thought about looking at paintings in that way, or they hadn't thought about that as a way to get to silence. So I feel that, you know, some people are actually paying attention or getting something from it, which is great. I mean, I'm very, very pleased.
Yeah. Yeah. Just opening up to the possibility.
Possibilities, yeah.
Is a wonderful thing. It really is.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for this hour spent together. And
well, thank you.
We didn't have much silence, but we pointed to it.
I meant to say that I just listened to your last one, and we don't have mountain lions in London, because I know that your last interviewee.
We don't have what?
Mountain lions.
Oh, the mountain. Oh, yeah. That was crazy. That was fun.
Anyway.
Yeah. So, everybody, we'll connect you with this beautiful book that here's for those of you who are going to watch on YouTube, The Lost Art of Silence. And reconnecting to the power and beauty of quiet. I think everybody can relate with that, that in their life, even a kid, being able to go in your room and just be quiet with yourself. Of course, you know, most likely you're going to be scrolling, doom scrolling, but still, if some awakening can happen in this area, it'd be a huge thing. So thank you for putting this together, Sarah.
And thank you, Raghu. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Sure. And we, of course, will have links so you can get the book and maybe mention a couple of the other books that we spoke about, Rilke and, Rilke and Aldous Huxley. Those are a couple of fine point twos, that's for sure.
Yep.
And thanks again, Sarah, and everybody. We shall see you next week. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and Jack Kornfield is there. You can catch him and a bunch of other people.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.